Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 43, where we are discussing organizational centralization and decentralization using the Federalist Papers 9 and 10 as models for a debate between the podcasters. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Okay, so previously we started our debates with the centralization camp taking the lead on kicking off the argument, not on winning, obviously.
Arguably.
So
now it would be the turn. Now I would say argue the decentralization camp should lead.
Okay. Well, let's just say that I don't necessarily look at it as oscillation, but what I see is that over time, an organization is going to centralize and centralize and centralize because of the very forces that we talked about in the first part, to the point where the autonomy, the liberty, the ability to function as an individual becomes so impinged upon that they can't stand it anymore. And so decentralization is the movement in the opposite direction. So I don't look at it as a true oscillation. Oscillation to me suggests that these are two equally weighted ideas that we just sort of swing the pendulum back and forth. What I see is this is a more of a resistance by those who value individual autonomy, growing more and more resistant towards the growing centralization of power within the organization. And let me kind of give that a particular example with respect to professional organizations and professions. And by profession, I'm referring to the Andrew Abbott variety, in which you have a community of professions who basically operate with autonomy granted by society. They are masters of a particular domain of expert knowledge. And so when you think of doctors, you think of lawyers, what type of organizations do they form? What do they do? They start out largely as small individual or small group practices or a firm, but usually, you know, it's small. And they are providing a direct service to clients. And over time, what happens? What have we seen? We've seen a consolidation out of calls for efficiency, out of concern for standardization of services, costs and other things. And like, especially in the medical profession within the United States, you see now larger and larger organizations, you know, not just, you know, movement away from corner doctor offices with direct access to the public, but now hospitals and networks of primary care providers, HMOs. I don't know what the current terminology is because it changes so frequently, but there's that much greater centralization being done, in which the spirit of professionalism, the autonomy of the individual doctor being able to provide direct personalized care to the patient, is impinged upon. Sooner or later, you end up with the problems with centralization that stifles innovation, that just it stifles innovation, and it also removes that direct personal contact with the client, that over time, the individuals start to rebel against it. And you start to see a need to sort of break things up a bit, and then it decentralizes. So that's kind of my take. And this is also, once again, you know, taking the side of decentralization. If I am an individual doctor, the last thing that I want is too many people looking over my shoulder, too many people who are not doctors telling me what to do. And that may or may not include patients as well. And I want to be able to provide the practice the way that I feel is best suited for the client. And that's to me would be in a decentralized fashion.
Okay, there is so much to unpack and counter-argue there. I think I would start with the idea that you proposed, that there seems to be, if I'm understanding it correctly, almost like a natural tendency, I don't want to say law, just a tendency to centralization to happen. So you say there's not so much oscillation, but actually, if anything is done to prevent it, centralization will happen. So there must be something to safeguard the autonomy, the creativity, the capacity of individuals. And regarding that, I think my rebuttal is actually that it is not necessarily like that. And I think actually it shouldn't, because one of the interesting things we have been talking, and I think that's important to stress, is that centralization can happen in many different ways. So it's not just the fact that organizations tend to centralize, I don't know, decision-making, or they're going to create more procedures, or the headquarters is going to have more power, or so on and so forth. But actually, this can be done in a variety of ways, which means that there is no natural tendency. You know, that would be, I think, my argument. But the case of doctors is very interesting, because it is true that we think in a more historical terms, in the way that the professions have evolved and how they have been bureaucratized, or to say more clear terms, how professions have been encapsulated by large organizations. And you give the case of healthcare providers. And of course, we can trace a different of sources and reasons and interlinked causes to that. But there is actually interesting research done by Forrest Briscoe on doctors. And I think one of the insights from his work shows that bureaucracy, and well, I'm using bureaucracy, but we can talk about centralization, you know, just this idea that they work in a specific kind of very formalized organizations in which there is a central mechanism for authority and design, you know, procedures and standards, actually welcome this kind of work arrangement in some aspects, because while it's true that you might lose some of your personal autonomy, so to speak, but actually there are many advantages in joining such centralized work arrangement. For instance, the fact that it's easier to hand off and hand over patients, you know, so this idea that you become part, I mean, it's almost like the happy story of being a cog in a machine, that is, you have your work and clear tasks to be done, but at the same time, since things are clear spelled out and there is a whole system behind your work, it's not you're deciding every single step you're making, it's easier to transfer a patient, it's easier to make the handover. It's easier to, you know, take holidays because you think you can go away and there will be someone that's going to, you know, keep the work going. So it is a great example, because there is empirical research which kind of shows a more complex and richer picture, I think, regarding that.
Right, but you don't need centralization to do those things. You can still pursue that in a confederate organization. Our argument behind centralization there is to harmonize processes and to harmonize different units, which goes directly to what Tom said. That, and I will add a little bit of a spin to that further, that centralization, which by its nature is exclusive, so it's a centralization to a particular way at the expense of other ways, is natural only insofar as the dominance of some factions over others is natural. So insofar as individuals and groups of individuals band together to derive advantage over other groups, centralization will occur, and decentralization is a opposing force to that. But it's not a situation that we inhabit where the only options are either band together or resist at all costs to your to your deficit, whether to your organization or anything else. You can have collective decision making, you can have collective harmonization, you can have collective standards without the need for giving up your authority, your ability to make decisions, or your autonomy in any way.
I think you make a good point. I think one of our challenges is in this debate is not to either stereotype or just talk about the extremes of the views. And you're always going to have within organizations, factions are going to exist, and there's going to be people who dissent from the way that the centralized authority says we ought to do it. I was thinking about patient care, and while Tom certainly made a good point about having greater autonomy to do the right thing, to treat patients as you know it or as you see it, the other perspective is standardized care or treatment protocols, which we're struggling with a bit in the United States to get doctors to adopt, that actually produce better care despite the fact it's not what the local doctor wants to do. I mean, there are those challenges that go on. And I think the issue is not whether factions are going to exist or not, or whether they're the majority will always get its way. I think the real issue is, and you see this in the Federalist Papers as well, is whether the other voice gets a chance to be heard and has a chance to have their view considered by the other group and potentially modifying the centralized authority's decision. I think that's the essence of it there. I mean, certainly you have a tyranny if at the local level nobody gets to make a alternate suggestion or they never get to provide an input. And I think Pedro made this argument in the first part of the episode where it's how that interaction happens, and it's not the same as saying, well, that they, you know, the other views or the, you know, won't be heard, because I think we do have pretty strong imperatives in organizations for cost control, for some standardizing certain kinds of procedures, introducing new technology and efficiency. I mean, I think those things exist and they're not going to go away. So I think the real issue is how do you not necessarily balance or find the golden point, but how do you find the way to get that input from the people who have the best ideas, as Tom was talking about, and yet at the same point not have everybody doing something different, which I think is untenable in larger organizations.
Well, part of this point that you brought up has also to do with, as Madison outlines in Federalist 10, whether an individual is allowed to judge himself or not, right? So is there a need for some kind of an arbitration mechanism, whether that be procedures, standards, centralized, you know, this or that, that would hold individuals or factions accountable, or is there no need for such a mechanism? And Madison is adamant that as long as you have interests and as long as you judge yourself, this will be a situation of corrupted integrity, right? So essentially, individuals who have a stake in something are not to be allowed to exercise self-judgment in those activities. And hence, we need a form of centralization to basically introduce safeguards for things like free speech, for things like selecting reputable opinions that you mentioned, Ralph, and so on and so forth. But this is not an absolute true premise, is it? Shouldn't it be the other way around, really, that individuals with a stake should be allowed to self-assess because they have a stake in this? They have a stake in performing well. They have a stake in, individuals and factions. Yes, there's going to be some degree of corruption, but by and large, by the force of, you know, collective selection and collective self-regulation, by and large, this will work out to, or should work out to an extent where a group of individuals acting to their self-interest and regulating themselves as such, and think of peer reviews here and other such activities, will in fact, and should in fact, be allowed to judge their own cause. And so there would not be a need for centralized procedures and centralized safeguards that would permit kind of the ascension of minority views or whatever, or less powerful views, because this would be the case anyway.
What is the point you're trying to make?
Yeah, well, the point, what I took away from this point, which I thought was a good one, which was you don't have to have centralization to get many of its benefits, that you could have other mechanisms that would help you get competing views aired and people would be able to argue for, even from a point of interest, which, and I agree, in Federalist 10, I think Madison is making an unrealistic argument that just by the creation of government and how you select the representatives, you'd never have that case where somebody was arguing something where they had a self-interest. He doesn't really address that particularly. So I agree that's a weakness of that argument. And I think what Demetrius and I are talking about is just one of the forms. So I think we're differing on how the forms would be created or what the mechanisms would be. But I think we, in contrast to people who are, you know, opposite ends of the debate spectrum, we do see you need these forums. Where we're different is from this the centralization versus decentralization view is how you set them up. I think he's more in the organic camp, if I'm getting that right, Demetrius, and I'm more of the you got to set up the procedures for it.
Yeah, I think I'm more cautious as the Confederates were to awarding any one faction, any one individual, any particular, or even a group of any ones mandate to decide what is kind of the way to go, if that makes sense. Because even though it may seem that, and we know this from research, that expert power can very quickly turn sour. Right, any form of power exercised by and withheld by a faction will almost likely be to the detriment of someone else. So my kind of position on this Confederate side of the lawn is that collective decentralized processes, while not as easy and while probably not as efficient, do work for the benefit of everyone, as opposed to a certain opinion of the few.
No, I was going to say, of course, I disagree, both in my role and I think also on as a personal opinion, because in a way, so I want to dispute this idea that centralization is actually bad in terms of the politics involved of what is a faction and how do we deal with plurality. Because I think the root of the issue here is how are you going to deal with disagreements. And if you have, what I understand you're trying to argue for is that if you have a more collective, organic kind of way in which the collective work itself out, so a decentralized one, then there is more space for different perspectives. Is that what you're arguing? So my point is actually, it's not necessarily, because the point is that one way of another, if you think of an organization or in the case of, you know, a country, a nation state, the important issue is that these different states, departments, groups, professional groups, people, individuals, whatever, have some kind of interdependence. And that becomes particularly interesting in our discussion in the realm of organizations, because it's not just the point that different ideas exist, but there is interdependence and competition and common resources they're trying to tap into, or a common market, or, I don't know, whatever it is that brings them together. So decentralization doesn't mean that there is going to be a happy family, because there are still going to be different ideas, and probably, you know, in a case of an organization, they might be competing for resources, they might be advancing different perspectives, they might have different opinions, and that, you know, the same way for a nation state like the US, the different states might be competing, they might be collaborating, they might have some kind of interdependence that bound them, they are bounded together somehow. So my argument would be, actually, centralization helps to deal with the plurality, helps to deal with the potential of disagreement, because then you have a specific forum in which these things can be argued in a more clear-cut, open way, instead of just, you know, leaving everyone to have their own perspectives and, you know, don't have in common channels to work them out properly.
But this is based on the idea that there is a better way to do this, right? It's based on the idea that a kind of open debate is necessarily going to be less productive, less beneficial, less effective than a structured one. But it's always going to be structured according to a particular agenda. You're always going to have power issues that come with controlling this agenda and including certain things that exclude other things. What we're going for is that the oscillation part there is simply the power struggles by certain groups to dominate over other groups.
Okay, let me toss out my idea, because one of the things I get concerned about is when interdependencies become somewhat fixed and durable to the point where we forget why we formed a collective in the first place. I'm going to use I use an example in from the sports, and I'm not talking about any particular sports league, but just imagine sort of the challenges between the players and the owners, if you will. It, you know, at one point, of course, you know, way back, the owners had all of the power, and in a number of sports leagues, the athletes received far less than their market value in terms of compensation. So we have unionization, and now you have players' unions and that are formed, and the owners are now more organized under a usually under some sort of a commissioner. I don't know. I mean, that's probably an American term. I don't know how it is with European sports leagues or others. But basically, now you, if you're going to play in the professional sports league, then you're going to wind up being either a part of one of these unions, or you're going to be in some rather odd status. I don't know to what extent different sports leagues afford opportunities for individuals to not be part of their respective players' unions, but the role of the union is very, very strong. And the role on the owner side, you know, basically now what you have is you have two very, very large, complex bodies that do negotiations on behalf of all owners and all players in order to keep the leagues, you know, basically to manage the distribution of resources, money, other collective bargaining interests. So then, you know, that's all well and good. We've built up this, you know, the sports world has a lot of these arrangements in place. But then what happens when, say, a particular group of owners on one side starts to find that the, you know, the collective of owners is not necessarily operating within the best interests of all the individual owners separately, or that the union starts to run into difficulties with its own players? Because those two bodies have become durable entities, there's not really an option to say for either side to break the whole thing up and start over, or at least it's not an easy decision. And I can't think of an instance where, you know, you have something quite that extreme on the horizon. But certainly what has happened is that you have had in the United States a number of work stoppages that are the result of a breakdown of negotiations between the two sides. And the question that I have, you know, especially if I'm coming at this from a decentralization lens, is that there's no opportunity, there's no alternative, I guess is the best way to put it. You either are stuck in, you know, as basically being the recipient of whatever breakdown of negotiations occurs. You can't form rival leagues, or rival leagues are extremely difficult to perform to create. I mean, we had cases in which the owners, in the time of a player strike, tried to use replacement players. That's not really much of an option. It dilutes the value of the sport, and it also creates, you know, intense labor problems. So what you have is that the institutionalization of this, you know, owner-player dialectic has created a condition in which the ability for those who would like to have other options available simply don't have them, because they're either politically dangerous or, you know, financially dangerous or what have you. The risks are simply too high. And I just – thinking again, promoting the decentralization view, should we allow that to happen, or should we try to find some other ways to provide more opportunities for those who don't want to be part of that, you know, who don't want to get stuck or imprisoned by that sort of going on?
So many things. I think, can I go back first to what Dimitris was saying, and then I'm arrived to your point, Tom. Dimitris was saying something related to the nature of where centralization and all what comes with actually helps the resolution of conflicts and disputes, and or just it leads to one faction taking over all the other different plurality of ideas, which is related to what you're saying as well, Ton. And I think the point there is that without centralization, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have a hippie space in which everyone can speak their mind and can be heard. Actually, research in organizations shows that when you do, for example, meetings with different experts in healthcare, there's actually research done on that, on multidisciplinary teams in trying to decide on diagnosis. The people that in the professional status are perceived as more senior, or within the hierarchy of healthcare, some professions that are perceived as, you know, more relevant in specific aspects of the diagnosis, actually, they control the agenda implicitly. For example, surgeons tend to dominate vis-a-vis nurses. So the point of centralization is by making these structures, I would say, explicit somehow, then there is a condition for better egalitarianism. Because Dimitris was actually saying that, you know, he was trying to conflate an open situation with a more egalitarian. But I think it's actually the other way around. When it's open, what you have is always power, because power always exists, and domination. But you don't have a way to point it out or to construct a grid in which you can potentially, not always, of course, but potentially give, you know, speech turns for people, or spelling out what are the procedures to be taken to make decisions, and so on and so forth. Now to arrive to what Tom was saying, which is an interesting case because it's more in a historical dimension, and the issue, I think, very much reflects what has been talked about on the problem of oligarchy, that is, when you have specific people that represent each other. In this case, you have a union of players, or the, a representative for the owners in this industry, then there is always the risk, and that's true, that the people that at the top might necessarily be reflecting the perspective of all the others involved, you know. And then, as you're pointing out, there is no alternative. So there is just this central voice, or no voice at all. But then I think the issue is not so much whether we have to go back somewhere, or, you know, or just drop the centralization, but actually to go back to what Ralph was saying before. It's a matter of checks and balances. It's a matter of how this can be worked out differently. You know, it's the point of, it is true there's always going to be potentially corruption. It is true that people might maneuver their position to position the agenda in given their own parochial interests, not of the collective. But that is not a matter that we have to drop representativeness as a whole, but actually create ways to alternate power, create ways to make sure that this, you know, there isn't, for instance, is enough alternation in the higher positions in which people can speak up, or creating, how to say, affirmative actions that specific voices can be heard, and so on and so forth.
All right, I think that was a great point, Pedro. And the only rebuttal I was going to give to Tom, because I think he made some really good points about what do you do when you have this centralized authority and these centralized structures, when somebody doesn't fit in or they want to do something different. And that's always going to be a challenge when you centralize authority or centralize procedures. You're going to get some people who either genuinely don't fit into the system because of various, you know, talent levels or capabilities, or, you know, those kinds of things, or people who don't want to and want something different. And the question really is then becomes, well, what's better for the organization as a whole? If you there's a risk. You know, I use the word anarchy in the part one of the episode because, of course, that's the language that's used in the Federalist Papers. And there's this risk that you can give too much voice to the people at the non-hierarchical levels. I don't want to say the bottom of the organization, but, you know, different levels of an organization. And then you can't coordinate things. And Pedro, I thought, made a very discussed about that in healthcare. That was one of the examples I was going to use.
So, Pedro, I wasn't trying to say that decentralization is somehow an open... Because I wasn't conflating that with egalitarianism. Quite the opposite. The argument for decentralization in this situation is actually threefold. One is that decentralized units would be closer to the problem, right? Because they're not bound by central procedures. Two is that the whole system of decentralization is more robust. There isn't a danger of faulty centralized arrangement just breaking everything down. And that was kind of the Tom's example, that because we have this dialectic between the owners and the players, we're kind of the people stuck in that situation are stuck, which is not an optimal way of conducting a system or a society or an organization. And third is that in a decentralized argument, kind of in a decentralized decision-making situation, there is less chance of collusion by factions. That's what I meant when I said that centralized systems are necessarily systems that are bound to a faction or a oligarchy of factions. In a decentralized environment, collusion is far harder to achieve than it is in a centralized environment. And by the extension of that, yes, it may be more egalitarian, but more importantly, it's more respective of individual autonomy and individual legitimacy as independent actors. Instead of surrendering those values and characteristics for the benefit of efficiency or on the altar of some false agenda of harmonized cooperation, it's possible to enact decentralized systems that both embrace that and still function well and function to achieve the goals that they are there to achieve. It may take a bit longer, it might not look as pretty, but the point is that the decentralized units, the individual autonomy and the sovereignty of those units will be maintained. It will not be laid down for the benefit of a faction that is in power.
Well, what I think we're coming to in this part is that none of us think there's a golden mean or best point on the spectrum, that a lot of this depends on the nature of the organization and the competitive environment and the technology and those kinds of things. And I note that in Federalist 10, Madison almost does the same thing. He's actually looking at both ends of the, or at least both edges of the spectrum for centralization and decentralization, because while he is arguing for a more centralized authority, he does make the point that if you enlarge the sphere, the word he uses, extend the sphere, and when he says sphere, he means from which the electorate chooses representatives and you have these representatives in Congress, and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests, you make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens, or if such a common motive exists, it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and to act in unison with each other, which I think is very close to the argument Demetrius is making. And interestingly enough, Madison, who's arguing for the centralization side, also makes the same argument. And that's all for part two of episode 43. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing organizational centralization and decentralization using the Federalist Papers 9 and 10 here on Talking About Organizations.